Dutch Horizons, Reflections from the Netherlands with Liesbeth de Bakker.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Dutch Horizons. I'm on the glorious island of Sri Lanka, or Ceylon, as it used to be called before its independence in 1948. Because of its strategic position, this jewel in the Indian Ocean has seen many visitors, both today as well as in the past, including the seafaring Dutchmen and other Europeans that came with the VOC, the Dutch East India Company. In fact, this year it's exactly 400 years since the first Dutchman set foot on Sri Lanka. And that's why, in this program, I'll take you on a tour through our shared history. But first, let's hear how it all started. My first port of call here in the capital, Colombo, is Dr. Roland Silva. He's a leading authority on our mutual heritage and president of the Sri Lanka-Netherlands Association.
The Dutch-Sri Lanka relations did not commence with a conquest of Sri Lanka. If there is an element of a conquest, the Dutch conquered the Portuguese who were occupying the maritime provinces of Sri Lanka. They did not occupy any of the land that belonged to the Sri Lankan kingdom. On the other hand, that took place only in 1658. But the Dutch relations began in 1602, and we are now in the 400th year of that. So in other words, 56 years prior to the Dutch occupying the Portuguese territory in Sri Lanka, the relations had already been established.
3rd of June. The general once again went ashore with various presents to pay his respect to the king. He took with him some musicians who were able to play various instruments. The king himself, with a naked sword, welcomed the general, who gave him the presents. After having heard the music and other instruments played, which pleased the king very much, the general was taken into the house of a high representative, where he and his men were treated well. A quote from the original captain's log of Joris van Spilbergen, the first Dutch envoy to Ceylon in 1602.
Spilbergen returned home, carrying with him three important grants of the king. First, the grant of a unique monopoly in exporting pepper, a unique grant in the export of cinnamon from Sri Lanka, and the third was a permanent storage for such exports in the form of a storage fortification at Batticaloa, where his ship was moored. So these three grants were given to him as a very special grant of the king to the first ambassador of the Dutch in 1602.
How do you perceive the relationship between Sri Lanka and the Netherlands?
I'm about to publish a 7-volume record of what I feel are the 7 buds that are about to bloom of this good relationship of 400 years.
Could you tell me what those 7 buds are?
The 7 buds will consist of 7 volumes, each on something that we feel is special, that the two nations have been able to get together. Number one is that wonderful achievement of cartography. The Dutch maps and plans of Sri Lanka are outstanding. They can be counted among the best in the world. Number two are the forts. We have over 22 Dutch fortifications in this country and in very good shape. I always tell my good friends from the Netherlands that we have more Dutch fortifications in Sri Lanka than what they profess to hold and preserve now. And I'm glad to say that the Dutch fort in Gaul is indeed the first colonial fortification in Asia to come on the World Heritage List. And we are very proud of that. And we call it an architecture of dual parentage. And that's the spirit in which we work. It may be the designs of the Dutch, but it is the sweat and toil of the people of this country.
Now, of course, I had to see the fair city of Gaul for myself, so I travelled 120 kilometres down south to even hotter and more humid weather. But even that doesn't deter me to go out sightseeing today. And here with me is Dr. Robert Partasius. You're an archaeologist from the Amsterdam Historic Museum and also a specialist on mutual heritage. Can you tell me, where have you brought me to?
Well, we're here now at the most southern part of the city, of the fortifications, and it's called Flag Point. And this was actually the place where the Dutch had their big flagpole to signal with the ships outside. And if you look over the sea now, you're looking over the Indian Ocean, you can see several ships on the roadstead in front of the bay. And that was also the place where the Dutch ships, and later ships after them, of course, arrived. And it's, of course, a central point here in the harbour. The English built a lighthouse later in the 19th century, which burned down, and now they built a lighthouse a bit more to the left. But it's still the place for the communication with the ships.
This is actually all part of the fortification, because Gaul was a fortified city, wasn't it?
Yes, this is part of a complete rampart system around the city built by the Dutch in the end of the 17th century. The Portuguese started with the fortification on a small area, only the anchorage in the bay, but the Dutch actually wanted to control the area around the bay also. So they built a complete fortified city.
And it's all still quite well contained. If you're on the bay, you actually see all the ramparts, and it looks quite nice still.
Well, a lot of them are built on natural rocks and extended by big rocks. And on some places we have problems. In one side, one of the bastions has been collapsed into the sea, so it has been preserved. And also on the bay side, where there's less severe sea conditions, and a part of the rampart has fallen into the sea and needs to be restored.
And behind these ramparts you see actually an old part of town that has still a lot of what they call Dutch houses in them, isn't it?
Yeah, well, one of the comments of a friend of mine who visited here, they said, well, if you walk on the ramparts and you close your eyes just a bit, think away the heat, then you can imagine yourself on a fortified city in the Netherlands, because all those red tiles are the same in the Netherlands.
So we've now entered the Dutch part of the old town of Gaul. Yes. And the houses here along the street are what they call here the Dutch type houses. Now, you live in one of the houses. What's your name?
Safa Ibrahim.
It's nice to meet you. Now, I understand that actually these houses have particular words for particular places. Can you explain me a little bit about that?
For the main hall, it's called Salia. And some of the fruits names are Dutch, like durian, mangosteen, if I'm not mistaken.
But you don't use the old-fashioned Dutch names anymore for your living room, for instance?
Now, when we say Saal, we think it's more singlish, but actually it's from Dutch.
It's Zaal in Dutch.
Yeah. That's right.
And the veranda has a different name as well?
Veranda, not to my knowledge.
I know that the houses had also in the middle an open area, and I know from people that that had also a Dutch name, but I can't recall it. How do you call your middle?
We call it Mutum.
That sounds like it must be buiten. Buiten.
We think Mutum is more Tamil word, because we're Muslims, we speak in Tamil. We think it's from Tamil.
I think it's, my mother was living in the center of Amsterdam, also in a small house, and they call it outside, buiten. Maybe it's the same, yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time. From the lovely town of Gaul, I'm taken on a one-hour drive to Matra, another ancient seashore town in the south. I've been told I need to go there because it would be a shame to miss another gem of shared history, a special fortified house in the shape of a star. In the display room, which is part of the house, I'm supposed to meet up with the local guide and one of the specialists of the Department of Archaeology in Sri Lanka, Conservator Anusa Kasturiarachi.
There is a model of the starboard in Matara. There is a water moat around the hall and can be seen prison rooms and gun point.
It's like a six-pointed star, and at every corner there was a gun.
Gun point, yes.
And what was it for? What was the purpose of the Matara fort?
Dutch captain was live in here.
He lived there.
Yes.
So he had a very well-protected house.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. The there's a prison room.
We're now entering the prison room. You can stand upright.
Poisons air come in these halls.
Poisoned air?
Yes, for prisonmen.
So if they want to kill the prisoners, they put poisoned
yes.
air in?
Yes.
Woo, didn't look very good. I think it's about 6 square meters in surface. So how many prisoners would go in here?
10 or 11 prisoners in this cage.
We're now walking up the wall,
yes.
the protective wall around yes. the house, and we can look over the bastions
yes.
into the town of Matra.
Yeah.
And on our right-hand side, we have the roof of the house. And actually, the courtyard is on our right-hand side inside.
Yes.
Now, was it important for the governor to have such a well-protected house? Because it seems a bit overdone. It seems a bit too afraid of what was here. Was there lots of people attacking or wanting to attack the governor?
In the ancient time, Dutch people try earn money. Elephant tax, wood carvings, like that. They got many things in our countries. So always single peoples fighting with Dutch people.
So they had to live in protected houses because the relationship at that time between the Sinhalese community and the VOC people wasn't very good.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Also, Dutch peoples married in Sinhalese girls also. Mm-hmm. My grandfather from Holland. I am Hendrikus. My surname is Hendrikus.
Pleased to meet you.
Yeah, thank you. I look for Dutch lady come here. I like to speak Dutch peoples.
So despite the fact that relations between the two countries haven't always been smooth, the local people today do not seem to bear any grudge at all against the Dutch colonial past. I asked my specialist, Dr. Roland Silva, why that is.
Friendship with the Dutch, like all good friends, they have moments of concern, but they were all overcome with grace and goodwill. And in a humorous way, we say the Dutch use the diplomacy of salt in negotiations. Namely, the Dutch, having occupied the maritime provinces, had a control of the flow of salt from the seashore to the interior. Now, when the diplomacy was not quite satisfactory, the flow of salt was in some ways closed or stifled. And when you did not have enough salt in your food, you knew you had to make some concessions to the Dutch.
But let's get back to the books you're preparing. What's the next one about?
Book number 3 is going to be on something much more spicy. It's going to be called Food and Spice of Dutch Good Living and Good Eating, covering the various menus and the various styles and customs and habits of cooking, and maybe even covering the utensils that are very special for the making of such food. And among them is a beautiful brew which we call milk wine, which is specially prepared around Christmas time. Then the brooder, which is a type of bread which everyone enjoys over Christmas.
Puffer cheese, brooder, s'more, pannekoek, bonchi.
Now the one person here in Sri Lanka who knows all about the Dutch heritage and home cooking is Miss Delarine Brogier. This lovely lady also lives in Colombo, and her Huguenot French ancestry goes way back to 1770, when her forefather, Jean Brogier, left the Channel Islands to go to Ceylon under the VOC.
From the Dutch kitchen we got the puffer cheese, pannekoek. Though, of course, the pannekoek we made was much daintier than what you eat in a restaurant in Holland. You got bonchi and you got s'more, which is beef in a thick gravy, doopfish. And have you heard of roeram? R-U-R-U-M, which is supposed to be Dutch, and is a runny kind of buttered eggs with the curry leaves that you find in the East. And I think those were the Dutch cooking specialities, delicacies.
Book number 4 is going to be something much more eternal. They are the tombstones of the Dutch. They are unique in that sense that they are beautifully carved, beautifully engraved, and the writing, the carving, and the artwork on these stones that were carved in Holland but brought as ballast in the ships from Holland to Colombo and then unloaded and replaced with the spices that went back to Holland in the same ships will form another interesting collection to the many books that we have produced.
Maybe you can explain to me where we are now.
Well, we're actually in the gardens around the graveyard, around the Dutch church, 18th century church in Gaul. But the interesting thing about this church is that it's kept so well, also in the sense of graves and all the typical European features in the church itself, up to the organ, it's preserved. And if you walk here and you look around, you can find all the Dutch graves. And they tell a story, of course. They tell a story of all those people that were living here. You see, for instance, here a schoolmaster. You will see the daughters of a commander of the city. People that lived here for quite a long time, or just for a few years, and they lost their beloved ones or died themselves here. And looking at the graves, in combination with that huge Dutch archive that still exists here in Sri Lanka, you can actually reconstruct a European colonial city in the 17th and 18th century.
Yeah, and I see names such as Antonis and Meekenkamp and Brohier and other names that have a Dutch ring to it.
Yes. So if you look at the commander who died here, he also had, instead of a grave, and we're walking into the church, there are a lot of older graves here. They're all Dutch. And here on the walls, there's a big wooden plate with decorations in commemoration of the commander of Gaul that died here in 1766. And this plate, well, it's almost a painting with all kind of decorations referring to death and the family weapon, survived all those years, which is, again, a very special thing.
Yeah, and what was the name of the commander?
The name of the commander was Abraham Smaland, and he was born in Colombo and commander of Gaul in that time for quite a long time. And the interesting thing is that you can also see in the society that was established here that it was not only people from Europe coming here having the highest functions, it were also people that were born here. This person is a Dutch person, but his father probably stayed already for a long time in Sri Lanka, in Ceylon, and he was born here and made his career here, probably never been back to Europe. So that's an interesting combination of European, but also already Sri Lankan, Ceylon people. And that's, of course, the famous group of burghers that are still forming community in Sri Lanka with all those strange habits that you can find in the Netherlands too. People like Mrs. Brohier, who is now really the burgher of Sri Lanka, and before her, her father, he was Mr. Gaul. He was the person who knew everything of this city.
About 900 families who had come under the VOC, the Dutch company, concentrated in Colombo, in Gaul, in Matara, in Jaffna, and other outposts decided to stay on. And that is how our family, or the burgher community, grew. Society and peoples and communities remained enclaved within themselves. That is, boy met girl in the drawing room of the parents. So the community kept its identity. By 1908, with the British period well advanced, this community, which was a strong, educated community, serving under now the British colonial system, they had leaders of that time who felt the community should be kept together. And they formed the Dutch Burger Union, which is still surviving, has had a series of outstanding burgers as their presidents. And I'm very proud to say that last year, end of July, I was elected as the first woman president of the Dutch Burger Union, a position I still hold today.
Now, is there selection in the Dutch burgers, who can and who can't be a Dutch burger?
By the terms of the union objectives and rules, the qualifying factor is that you came under the VOC. And we do have a committee that screens the applications of members. We have now a category of associate member and full member or voting member. And those who are not or who cannot be will always have a chip on their shoulder.
And how big is the DBU now? Is it a flourishing organization? Has it grown since the beginning?
In 1948, when we attained independence, in a total population of 8 million, the burgers numbered about 0.6%, which is roughly about 68,000 burgers in the total population.
But how many are there now?
It is hard to say. It could be about 0.02% or so, or even less, I would say. But nevertheless, the community still is recognized.
Do you think that the burger union will dwindle away over the coming decades, or is there a particular solid role that it has to play?
We are going through to revise the constitution because the community is very small and we are conscious of, shall we say, the forces, the eddies of change. So we must change ourselves, but we can always be a community within this multifaceted, multilingual population. And it's up to the generation of burgers of tomorrow to be proud of that. And unless they educate themselves and learn for themselves and understand the concept of their community, they will be lost in this expanding population.
The fifth book is much more the legal aspect of it. Legally, Sri Lanka still possesses what we call Roman Dutch law, introduced by the Dutch, but strangely, not operational in Holland. Roman Dutch law today prevails only in two countries of the world, namely South Africa and Sri Lanka. Much of the common law of this country is Roman Dutch law, so it applies to day-to-day life. In terms of possession, land transactions, marriage, and if you come to the courts in Sri Lanka, you'll find it applied on a day-to-day basis. And then, of course, we have the next book, which is Coins and Currency. Now, coins and currency is an extraordinary thing. It's very beautifully minted, is beautifully designed, and strangely, it was created and artistically handled in Sri Lanka. And it's a beautiful area to study. And we have some very unique specimens of coins and coinage of the Dutch period. And the last of the books covers art and architecture. It covers some of the finest works of the Dutch, namely the furniture, which is world famous.
Can you describe true authentic Dutch furniture to me, please?
Well, authentic Dutch furniture not only has good carving, it's a very unique wood. Wood that is unique to this country and in the tropics. The only other country is Indonesia that has this very special wood that was used. It is what you call calamanda. It is almost the wood version of the finest black marble. And within the black marble, if you can visualize a thin brown stain in it going into a white sometimes, that is the high quality calamanda. With it, in the same book, we will also be covering the very famous ceramics of the Dutch period with the VOC mark and any other decorative elements that appears in the architecture of the Dutch period. The Dutch architecture has had an enormous influence in the modern period of this country because they were very specially designed and very specially carved.
Just last night I found out that actually also the hotel I'm staying in is part of the Dutch VOC heritage. And I'm here talking to the owner of the hotel. Could you please tell me your name?
Paradijs Jijslander.
Can you tell me a little bit about this wonderful building actually that we're staying in at the moment?
Yeah, I think this was built in around 1735 by a Dutch governor. The governor was destined to Indonesia, Batavia, and his ship wrecked in Goal Harbor, and he was made to serve here for a short period till the monsoon or whatever the wind takes him back to Batavia. But during the short time, probably he decided to stay back in Sri Lanka, and then somebody else was posted to Indonesia, and that is how this name Nooit Gedacht came in. He never thought that he will be able to stay here for long.
What is the layout of the house? That it has a does it have a particular setup?
Typical Dutch architecture, which we preserve as actually architectural museum. You know, a lot of students from Columbia universities come and study this building because it's so environmentally friendly. You know, the sun coming into the house and the wind blowing across with the high ceilings. It's like an air-conditioned building today. So the main reason to build this house here is the spring behind the mountain, because the fresh water was very important for the large number of soldiers staying. And it is an island surrounded by sea with very little fresh water along the coast, you know. And also there was this thing, you know, where when the foreigners were trying to invade the country, the other part used to poison the wells. So it has to be a place with security, and that was possible at this particular land. Through a rock it comes here, and you can see the tank which was built by the Dutch at that period, and they have used this canal connecting the Goal Harbor to this place to take the fresh water to the ships also.
And here we see then actually up in the stone hill, we see actually a basin that's been cut out. Yes. And it looks like concrete, but I suppose it's made of stone?
It is made of limestone with mud and some sort of a clay.
Up and up and up. Here we go. Let's be careful here.
There's a rock spout. Yep. And from there the water comes into this tank. There are steps going into this tank. So the person who was living here probably had a nice time, you know, getting into the tank and having a bath from the spout and enjoying the sun. And
did the governor do that, you think?
I think so. He must have had a nice time here.
His official bath outside.
Yes.
So this is all still, well, made by Dutch hands as well, probably.
Of course, yes. This is not really a Sri Lankan architecture. It's typical foreign influence.
It's marvelous. And it's covered now with ferns and all kinds of brushes.
We are going to renovate actually from the ferns all these historical things.
And then I can have a bath here?
Yes, of course. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Maybe for the opening. You are welcome.
Okay.
Dutch Horizons has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.